Hey folks, just a quick reminder that this episode is not meant to be used for medical advice, just good old-fashioned education. All patient information has been modified to protect their identity, and the views expressed in our podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinion of our employers.
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers. We are so excited to have an amazing WGX episode today. I'm Priyanka, and I am so thrilled to be back with our Boss Lady group this week. I'm joined today by my co-hosts and WGX team member, Smitha. Today's episode is really special to us, as we're taking a break from our clinical case-based reasoning episodes to discuss a topic that we're really excited to learn more about.
Thanks, Priyanka. Today's episode will focus on the theme of negotiations in medicine. This week, we are so honored to have two amazing guest speakers and female leaders, Dr. Vinnie Arora and Dr. Katrina Armstrong. We are excited to hear their stories, their reflections, and their wisdom.
I have the absolute pleasure of introducing Dr. Vinnie Arora. Dr. Arora is an academic hospitalist and associate chief medical officer for clinical learning environment and assistant dean for scholarship and discovery at the University of Chicago. Through her role, she bridges educational and hospital leadership to engage frontline staff into the institutional quality, safety, and value mission. She is the PI of numerous NIH grants to evaluate novel interventions that combine systems change with learning theory to improve care, and an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine and the American Society of Clinical Investigation. She is a champion for women in medicine and was featured in the New York Times for an editorial that called to end the gender pay gap in medicine. Dr. Arora is a founding member of the nonprofit Women of Impact, dedicated to advancing women leaders in healthcare. And you can find her on her Twitter with the handle at FutureDoc.
We are so lucky to be joined by Dr. Katrina Armstrong. Dr. Armstrong is the Jackson Professor of Clinical Medicine at Harvard Medical School, Chair of the Department of Medicine, and Physician-in-Chief of Massachusetts General Hospital. She is an internationally recognized investigator in medical decision-making, quality of care, and cancer prevention and outcomes. She is an award-winning teacher and a practicing primary care physician. She has served on multiple advisory panels for academic and federal organizations and has been elected to the American Society of Clinical Investigation and the Institute of Medicine. Prior to coming to the Mass General, she was the chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine of the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the University of Pennsylvania.
Thank you so much for having me. I couldn't be more excited to join you today.
Thank you for having me as well.
We're so excited to get started on our awesome discussion. But before, I just want to let our audience know that we've checked in with our guests. And for the duration of this podcast, we will be using first names. So one of the things that is so exciting to me as a young woman about to start residency is that women are entering the field at much higher rates every year. We know that women matriculate from med school at higher rates than men, and we're seeing a rise in female leaders and change makers in medicine. And this is super exciting and inspiring to me, but it's hard for me not to acknowledge this elephant in the room, which is that gender disparities still exist. And they exist not just at a structural level, but also I think at an emotional and a mental level in the form of imposter syndrome, stereotype threat, and implicit biases.
Absolutely. And as I think about finding my first job out of residency, I would love to hear from you both how you would coach a young mentee like me. For example, if you were talking to one of your mentees, you know, maybe a young faculty member who struggles with imposter syndrome and is about to start interviewing for maybe a new job as a hospitalist, how would you advise her to advocate for her skills? And maybe we can start off with Dr. Vinnie Arora.
Thank you so much for that terrific question, and certainly reminds me of several meetings that I actually have in real life with some of my own mentees who are searching for jobs right now. And I would say that as young women in medicine, particularly leaving the residency fold of the shire that sometimes we call it, you know, you're protected and you're leaving the shire for the wide world where things are not easily coached and it's hard to see things, it can be difficult and it's normal to feel like you're not prepared or be adequate. And so the key is to skill up, talk to people. You know, when you have those mental roadblocks of imposter syndrome, the key is to talk to your champions. Who are your personal board of directors? How are they going to build you up? But at the end of the day, you are betting on yourself and you are the best asset you have, and you are your own salesperson. And so I think that is an important skill to get the hang of, because whatever you're going to be doing, whether it's clinical, leadership, education, or research, or, you know, a variety of other things you might be doing clinically, you have to be able to pitch yourself as the best person for the job in an interview situation. And so oftentimes, it helps to rehearse that, to mentally rehearse that with some of your toughest critics, to be like, this is my opening pitch. Does that sound right? Think of yourself as an entrepreneur who is trying to pitch a venture capitalist to fund you for your first job. You would never go in there being like, well, I don't really know if I'm the right fit for this. Like, that would be immediately somebody would be like, time out. You know, you would go in and say, this is why I think you should hire me. And so keep that in mind, because a lot of times, because women often are thinking about being liked, making sure they're sort of fitting a mold of femininity, they may not want to take that leap and say, I am confident. And being confident is not being overly confident. So I think for women, I would say some confidence is important, because usually it's oftentimes you're underconfident, and that would actually allow you to not see the gate and not present yourself in the right way in an interview setting. And so you do want to try to do that. And there's some easy ways to do that. One of the things I often start with is, you know, get on social media. Do you have a LinkedIn profile? Have you put your expertise out there so that people see that you, even if you're not actually actively promoting yourself, you've at least got a landing page that highlights your expertise and skills.
Well, so Vinny, I totally agree with everything you're saying there. You know, as I think about it, I think this imposter syndrome is such a common thing, right? And I think honestly for women, but across everybody starting whatever they do, one of the great lines that I love is that we all spend most of our lives comparing our own insides to other people's outsides. And I say that to my kids when they're trying to like apply for anything, you know, if I think about the residents, if I think about anybody. And so trying to understand, you know, what I try to convince them is that actually everybody is on your, like, they want you to succeed. They want you to rocket and to hire you. Like, that's actually the goal. And so I agree with Vinny, like, going and prepare, knowing what you're going to say, making sure that you have thought through the questions is really important. I think I'd add two other points from my perspective here. You know, the first is that if you look at interviews, the way that people judge an interview, and I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, is by how much they talk. So it turns out that everybody loves to talk about themselves. That is like universal. And so the most important skill that I would say, building on Vinny's point, is you should learn about the place you're looking and learn about the people you're talking to and be interested in them and interested in the institution and interested in what you will do. And that's true, honestly, whether my kids are applying to college or you guys are applying to a job or I'm talking to anybody, is it's about actually being interested and caring in them. And I always tell my kids, like, or any of my mentees, if you can get them talking more than you're talking, they're going to say that was a great interview. That's how you can judge an interview. I guess the, you know, second thing that I really focus on with trainees, I'm going to build this on Vinny's point here, is that actually there's a big difference between residency and medical school and your next environment. And so I think we have what I often call with the residents, medical students, a TMI problem. So you're used to going to your residency director or your dean, or maybe Vinny plays this role for everybody, and telling them, well, you know, I'm not really sure if I want to do research. I'm not really sure I might want to do this. That is really hard for like me as a chair hiring somebody, because I want to help you succeed. But if you don't know what you want to do, then I'm sitting on the other end of the table thinking like, oh my gosh, how on earth am I going to be able to help this person do what they want to do? Because they aren't sure. So I think there's a big difference about how you talk to your program director about what you might want to be, and maybe a fellowship director. I counsel fellows all the time about this and what you say in an interview. And so my advice is really the exact same, I think, as what Vinny's saying here, which is that I think you should be prepared. I think you should remember that imposter complex is every single person. I can tell you, it doesn't matter whether you're running the CDC or you're applying to your first job. That's true for everybody. They're thinking about those things. I think you're aligned with what they want. Make sure you learn about them and you're interested in them. And then for when you go in there, decide what you want to sell, decide who you are and go with it. That is really critical.
I love how tangible and practical these tips and the advice is. One question that came up for me as I was hearing you both talk was, how do you balance the need or desire to be both authentic, but also to sell oneself and put your best foot forward? Do you feel like those are in tension?
One thing I will say, and I try hard to coach people with this, is you guys are doctors. Maybe not, you know, Priyanka, I don't know. When are you going to be a doctor? Are you a doctor yet? Or is it?
In a couple months.
Okay. You're going to be a doctor,
it's
right?
It's a matter of weeks.
So you guys have learned how to bring a part of yourself to an interaction with the patient, right? You wouldn't, let's say that you had a terrible day and you like crashed your car. I don't know if people have cars in San Francisco, but assuming you could have a car, you crash your car on the way to work. You're not, when you meet a patient who has a new cancer diagnosis, going to talk about your car crash. You're going to figure out how to be present in the way that that patient needs. That's not inauthentic, right? That is deeply authentic because you're respecting the person on the other side of the table, who they are and what they're there. So when you come into an interview, I try to get people to think about it the same way. Be respectful for the other person and where are they coming from? What are their needs? And so I think when you tell them who you are and what you will bring to this position, you're actually being respectful of what they need from you. Does that, they need to know what would you bring to this position and who are you? That doesn't mean they want to hear that you like won the spelling bee in eighth grade. I wouldn't bring that up. Does that make sense? I would talk about the job and why you are going to be so great at actually moving that job forward. Does that make sense? They don't want to know that you're like the best ballet dancer in Texas. It's about your professional ability to move that forward. I don't know, Vinny, what you think.
You know, I always say everybody wants a closer. The last thing you want as a boss is somebody who doesn't close the deal. And it sounds very business oriented, but the truth is, you know, when I ran recruitment for a residency program to even now when I'm looking for hiring, you know, people in faculty positions or research assistants, I'm looking for somebody who's going to follow through. We're all generalists and we all did internal medicine. And as a result of that, oftentimes we like to dabble and we all like to take on too much. And that's just, you know, par for the course. And if you're a woman, you're multitasking on top of that. These things are deadly. And so, and especially for internists, I will say it's important to show that you can close the deal. And it doesn't matter what the deal is. When I was a chief resident, I organized the citywide ACP conference. That's something I actually can share. Like, well, I think I'm a great fit for you. I have great leadership ability. And, you know, one experience that I can bring to bear is that I, you know, was able to organize the citywide ACP conference and here are some challenges and here's how we worked it out. So the key is that you can leverage your experiences, but pull out the skill sets that are unique, not just unique, but sort of just core for everyone. So every boss is looking for somebody who's going to close the deal, somebody who is, you know, a listener, a good listener, somebody who can sort of take initiative, you know, and sort of thinking about that RIME education model, reporter, interpreter, manager, educator. None of us wants to hire a reporter, you know? Nobody wants to have the faculty come in to be like, you know, town crier, there's a, you know, problem in the workroom. Like, yes, but tell me what you're going to do to help me fix it. And so many of us, those QI skills are really helpful too. So many of the things that you do in residency that are, you're like, oh, I'm here doing a required QI project. a lot of my mentees are like, thank you so much for that opportunity to do QI. That was the thing that really helped me get this job, because I was able to show that I could solve a problem with data and get it. And no matter which job you're going for, whether it's in the community or in academia or in policy or wherever, people want those skills where you can close the deal and problem solve. So those are some ways to leverage your expertise to show that you have valuable skills that are important.
I love that. I really appreciate not just your best practices and tips, but also this real message of bringing in your own personal cheerleaders and your own authenticity to share your truth, because that's sort of at the background at whatever we end up deciding to do. And I loved what you were saying, Vinny, like just around leveraging yourself and leveraging your skills. And I think that really segues well into the core topic that we want to discuss today, which is this idea of negotiation. And for me, I've really only heard negotiations been used a lot in like business school and business deals. And I really have no context of how this really applies in the real world for me entering the field of medicine. And so I would love to hear, Vinny, we can start with you, what your personal and professional experience with negotiation has been like.
Well, that's a great question. I will definitely say that as you go up the ladder, negotiation is important, and it gets even more important for leadership positions. Early on, I think that we prime, especially maybe even over prime women in medicine, to be like, you got to go in and negotiate. And so in some jobs that might, people might ask for the sun and they're like, well, I'm negotiating. But then they start out with this like overstretch, unrealistic ask. So I've seen the pendulum swing the other way. And so I think that the art of negotiation is really about knowing what it is that you need in order to take a job. And then figuring out at what point is it not worth this, you know, if I don't get these things, at what point do I say this job is not worth it for me? And then making strategic asks in areas that show that you're going to need those things to be successful. And there's certain buckets of negotiating, you know, in terms of what are those buckets, you know, sometimes for early faculty in academia, I say, yes, there's a gender pay gap, and maybe you want to ask for more money, and maybe more money is the key. But oftentimes academic salaries, interestingly, are flat and start at the same level. And so you might be haggling over something that's not really movable. And where we often lose pace as women is at the transition point, as we get promoted, or, you know, somebody else got a counteroffer, et cetera. So just keep in mind that you may go in thinking like, I'm going to be, you know, underpaid, but what you might need in order to be successful in that job is more administrative support in your clinic, or more time to, you know, maybe it really is valuable for you not to have Friday afternoon clinic, or to be, you know, make sure as a hospitalist that you have the necessary CME funds or an educational development to go to the next level to skill up. So early in your career, don't forget to negotiate for the things you need that are go beyond salary, so that you can be successful in your job and that you feel good that you're investing in yourself and the institution's investing in you as well. And so that's my general pitch, is that, you know, it can feel awkward to make those asks. But when you say, in order to be successful in this job and to do really well, I think I would benefit from the following so that I can do a better job for you, it shows that you are being thoughtful and that you are actually thinking ahead as a, you know, the long view, so that you are looking ahead. And that actually shows tremendous insight. And so there's nobody in the world who's going to want to hire somebody for them not to be successful. So if you frame it that way, and it's not like, well, I'm here to negotiate for the sake of negotiating, and I know you're underselling me, so I'm just going to ask for, you know, extra money, you know, that can feel very off-putting. But if you make it sound like, these are the things in my package that I need, and you can add in, you know, for example, you could say, you know, in order to be successful, I need it to work at home, and it would be beneficial to me if I had a little bit of a bonus so that I could cover some of the extra needs that I had at home. That's kind of the way to highlight some of those issues, so that you can share a set of points that make it look like you are thinking very strategically about how you will be successful in that position.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that, you know, from my perspective, and maybe just picking up on a point that Vinny said, is that I think we often confuse two things that they talk a lot about in, you know, business literature around negotiation, which is a single event negotiation and a relationship-based negotiation. And so most negotiations you guys are going to do are relationship-based, right? They're not about going to buy a car, right? Where you honestly don't really care and you may never see that guy or woman again, right? It's just about the car. And there's lots of car dealerships, right? And so if you actually have a bad experience with one, the challenge with your boss is that's somebody you're going to be working with a while, right? Like my guess is that you're going to be working with them. And the most important thing is your relationship with that person. I do so much negotiation with people wanting a faculty job. And I can't tell you that I want to like start out every time with them and say like, at the end of this, what you want is that when you show up in my office, I'm happy because then I will give you more stuff. That's just how life works, right? If people engender positive emotions in me, life is going to be better for them. It's just the way it works. So I would suggest from you, I think that it's really key that you guys think about what is a single event negotiation and what is a relationship-based negotiation. And then I just want to bring up one other point that Vinny said, because I think this stuff drives me crazy sometimes. So we as women argue that we, and I'm all for this, that there should be transparency and equity in all of our salaries and our documents. So I am very transparent. We give the same packages. We have the same hiring. Like I can tell you what people get paid. And then at the same time, sometimes I think as Vinny's saying, women have been coached so much that they're not negotiating that they come in and tell me, well, I don't want that. I want something else. I'm like, well, what do you like? We can't have this both ways. So I think when you're starting out, the key, like Vinny says, is get that job that you're going to like figure out how you guys are aligned and how you're going to succeed in the job. But don't go tell them you need like $20,000 more just because somebody told you you should be negotiating, because we've spent a lot of time having equity in how we hire people.
I love the relationship part of that, Katrina. I couldn't agree more. Certainly not. You would hope your job is not like your used car. So I think that's where knowing who you're negotiating with is critical. And it's so hard to do that for a new job. Sometimes you're renegotiating later in your career with your current boss. And that is really like an awesome experience because you know your boss and you know they know you and you're very authentic because you're like, you know, it would mean a lot to me if the following could occur. And it's not necessarily like I need it now, otherwise I'm walking away. It's like, this is what I want to work towards. And so if you think about that, like every time you meet your boss, these are your aspirational goals, you know, and that's important because we hire people all the time, like chief residents who obviously want to have a dedicated protected time in medical education, which is this highly coveted thing that only a few people get, but you don't usually get it out of residency. But there are certainly amazing educators like chief residents and others that got hired and they volunteer and they do recruitment committees and they get mentored and they might negotiate so that they can participate in a faculty development program at a conference like ESGYM or something. And that's a good thing to negotiate for. Then in subsequent meetings with your boss, you're like, well, I'm working. Here are some of the things I'm done. And, you know, I know that in 5 years, I hope to be a clerkship director or an APD or somebody like that. Then your boss is like, now they're a sponsor and now they know what you're thinking about. And when the time comes, they have you in mind. And so keep in mind that a lot of what you're doing when you're setting up yourself for that first job is you're setting yourself down a trajectory and you want to preserve the relationship. In a job negotiation I had a while ago, I didn't ask for extra resources for staff because I was like, I have staff. What I need is money and I need some liberty to do things. And if I need more staff, I'll come back to you. And then, you know, a year later, I'm like, well, I could benefit from a staff. So the key sometimes is that relationship is you, it's a give and take. And what you don't take is actually going to be remembered when you ask for it later. And so I think that's also very very important, because if they give you a lot at the beginning, they're going to be reluctant to give you later. So you really want to know, what do I need most? And that is really what is the key to negotiation.
This has been so incredibly helpful. And what I'm hearing is that because negotiating is often relationship-based, that in some ways it actually becomes easier to negotiate over time as that relationship builds. I'm wondering earlier on though, how do you know, you know, when or what to ask for and what you need in that job and what is appropriate to negotiate for?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I usually suggest to people when you're looking at a job, you really need to talk to people there. And, you know, I guess I'll say, and just building kind of what Vinny was saying, you know, I think the key thing that we often forget is like, you're trying to build trust with that person, right? And so if you build trust with that person and it turns out you need something else to accomplish your job, they're going to trust you. They don't think you're like making it up, right? They're going to want to support that. But if you look at a job at a place, I do think getting to talk to the people there, having some contact with people who are doing that job and understanding, I think there's a lot to be said. And I know this may sound like hard to do, but just asking people, what did you get paid? How did you get hired? How did it work? And I will tell you, if you go to a high trust environment, people are going to talk. They're going to be happy to share. And so I often will say it's less the actual answer to that question than people's willingness to answer that question, if that makes sense. And so I think if you guys go into negotiation, just try to learn, be interested and learn, and don't just talk to the one person, try to meet with other people there. And I think you'll get a ton out of it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Katrina. You've got to talk to people. And also think about coaching. You know, a lot of times people talk about mentorship. That's like a long-term relationship with somebody for your professional development. There are people that are really good coaches at negotiating. And what, you know, somebody who I've contacted in the past, Darrellyn Moyer, a physician leader for ACP, American College of Physicians. So Dr. Moyer, I mean, she gives talks on this. She's really good at it. That I learned a lot from her about earlier in my career at a workshop about negotiating. And so just keep in mind that there are times when I might just be like, am I thinking about this the right way? And I might just shoot her a text and be like, you know, what do you think? And it's not, she's not my mentor. She's just sort of like a coach on that space. And so think about, for you at that level, is there somebody who's a coach, you know, a faculty member in your residency program that could say, well, do you mind looking at this letter and seeing whether or not I should be asking for anything? And a lot of times, you know, when I'm looking at letters like that, I often say, well, is your clinical support spelled out? You know, where's your office? Is your research support spelled out? If you're a researcher, is your, you know, do you need CME funds? Don't forget to negotiate for the resources that you need to be successful. And sometimes the letters that you get are vague and that puts you at risk. And so that's where I say, it's not necessarily that you're negotiating for $20,000 extra, you're negotiating for security that you've got what you need in order to be successful. Maybe it's very important to you to get to the SHM or SGM meeting because you're on a committee. So you write in there that you won't be on service during that time. That is something that's very valuable to you and very important to you. You wouldn't think about putting that in your letter, but that way, as the new kid on the block, when the schedule is made, you're like, oh, I can't do that. I have a committee meeting. And you know what? No one's going to touch you for it because they know that you already agreed to that. So I'm highlighting things that matter to you that you might not actually be aware of that are important. And also mentorship. I often do let people know you should see if you can write in who your mentor is and some meetings with that mentor so that it's very clear that you're taking a job that's not mentorless. And a year later, it's like, well, you know, I don't really have a mentor, you know? So having that in writing also is very protective, because it opens the door for you to say that person is now responsible for your professional success. And sometimes that's your division chief and sometimes it's not though. And so you need to kind of figure out who that's going to be.
I mean, I guess I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I do think sometimes in my experience, people get, I think the reason to have it in the letter, honestly, is it's just that you've had the conversation. And I think it's about the conversation more than the letter. I will be careful. There's no letter that we write that doesn't say, like, if the world falls apart, we can't do this, right? Because the reality is, think about COVID, right? What letter actually like meant anything over the last year, right?
So that is a good point.
I think it's about the conversations from my perspective. I guess the only piece I would argue for you guys is, as you, I think it's just to build on one of Vinny's points for everybody listening. As you build your career, things are going to be different, right? And so I love the point that Vinny made, that it's about the long term. One thing that I learned very early on in my career is every year I wrote my boss a letter about what I did that year and what I hoped to do. And I didn't ask for anything. And it was really about kind of giving him the knowledge to be able to help me. And my success was really important to him. I also learned to write the letter, because if you go in to meet your boss, and I try to get people to do this with me now, if you go in to meet your boss without having sent them a letter, they're panicking. They're thinking, oh my gosh, I wonder what's happening. Maybe they're going to quit. Maybe they've got a problem. Maybe they need this. So I would strongly encourage you. I try to always say, just spend a moment putting yourself in the other person's shoes. Send them a letter. You don't have to have an ask. It's a long-term, or an email, doesn't it? But like, it's a long-term relationship building thing. I guess the only thing I wonder, Vinny, listening is, you know, I can see this argument about like block SGIM or block SHM. But, you know, another key part, and I know for residents, you guys get this, is your relationship with your colleagues. And your success is going to depend in part on your colleagues wanting you to succeed, right? It's a win-win from my perspective. It can't be that there's one person in a hospital medicine group or in general medicine or in the department. It has to be that we all rise together. So absolutely. I wonder, Vinny, like how you think about that when there's kind of rules about coverage or other things, to put that in a negotiation or not.
So I think it's good to ask about it. And here's why, because you don't want to be 5 years in and always covering SHM. So, and that's why the negotiation happens. If you're on a committee and you need to go that year, you know, you write it in because you're at risk for not going because you're the junior person, but you're probably, of course, you're not going to get it every year, right? So the key is that there's some understanding that over the next 5 years, because usually all of these have term appointments, there's some, you know, you're appointed for some term, 2 years or 5 years. You might say, you know, I will attend either one of these meetings, you know, and it doesn't have to be the same one, once every other year. So you can figure out a way. But the other, you know, the question is, do you want to be the one on call every holiday for 5 years, right? On the same holiday, you know, those are the types of things that really burn people and burn them out 5 years in. So what you're trying to do is just state your preferences. And again, you're not asking for a lot. At that point, you're not asking for a lot. And there's an easy way to get to a middle ground, which is, okay, what if we do it for this year? We obviously can't guarantee it for the following year, right? So those are just things to keep in mind, you know? And I mention that because I've seen oftentimes, especially in hospital medicine, everyone is so hungry to just get a body in that sometimes that professional development is not there. Now, having said that, you may be being hired at a position that's less than full faculty, you know, like a clinical associate or more of a clinically oriented position. These are things to know. Like, what are your benchmarks for promotion at your next step? And how, what commitment do you have to get there? And so if your benchmark for promotion is that you're presenting and you're establishing leadership, then you've got to get to the meeting and you have to get to some meeting. And so I think these are the types of things you want to discuss, because I've seen a lot of junior hospitalists 5 years in, and then they're like, I've been a good foot soldier, you know, I've admitted and a discharge, but I don't have anything to show for it. And I would say that's where I feel like general medicine has done a better job of being much more focused on the career development. And we need to kind of have that conversation a little bit more clear, because hospitalists are partly so needed by the hospital that, and of course, you know, there's a pandemic, but just highlighting that, you know, again, over the course of 5 years, you'll get to two meetings. These are the types of things that really matter to people, you know?
This has been super helpful to hear what matters, how you kind of advocate for the things that then matter. I'm curious, you know, once, you know, as a young faculty member, we get a contract or have an offer, what happens next? Do you take it to your different mentors to kind of get some feedback on it? Like, where do we go from there?
You know, I would say that oftentimes, so this, it'll vary by your organization and your who you're working with. Some jobs come with standard offer letters. And that's why I say those early jobs have standard offer letters. employers often. And, you know, because Katrina mentioned equity, there's maybe little wiggle room there. And but you're just posing the questions so that people know what matter to you. You may not get everything in writing in the letter, but you have a reassuring conversation on some of those points. Then you're usually given a date to return the letter by. And so when I see a lot of young people, they stress out a lot about that date. Now, of course, that date, you know, you have to go talk to your family, you have to talk to your friends, you have to do some soul searching to be like, is, you know, moving across the country the right thing for me to do? And there is often wiggle room in the date. And so I will say that keep in mind that that's also a negotiation. Maybe it's like, I'm in the middle of studying for the boards and I need to deal with something and I am hoping to get back to you. I need to talk to my family by X date. So you can push the date a little bit out. That gives you a little bit of time to do some due diligence and talk to some people to make sure that you're making the right decision. I would say that at the end of the day, it's alignment of the location for your and your job and what you're going to be doing and whether it's both right for you personally and right for you professionally that's going to matter most. That conversation is not necessarily about the letter. That conversation is about making sure, you know, all of the ducks line up in your life personally and professionally. It'll take you a little bit of time to think that through. So you should think that through, but keep in mind that the other side is also trying to figure out who their offers are going out to and fill a position. And you don't want, I have seen the position sale, so you don't want to wait too long. But if you need an extra week, usually that's never a problem. I've never seen that a problem. And so I'd be curious what Katrina has to say there as well.
No, Vinny, I totally agree. Timing is always one of these issues. You get a letter. I would say the first thing you guys should do is celebrate, right? Go celebrate however you want to do that. I think in medicine, sometimes we lose the celebration of moments. We should seize these moments. It's a great thing. Somebody offered you a job. That's the first thing I would do is just don't read it and stress about why did they in paragraph 8 say this? I would just celebrate. And so that's my first piece of advice. And we should do that way more often for so many things in medicine, I think. So I think the second piece of advice I would have is when I offer somebody a job, I think it is perfectly reasonable for them to say to me, is there anything in this that is flexible or might be able to be modified if it would work better for me to do it a different way? And I think you can ask that, right? I think we sometimes we feel like we're over in our corner, adversarial against the person who offered you a job. That's crazy. If you think you're fighting the person who's offering you a job, that is not a good job to take. Take a job for somebody who you want to work for. And then if there are things, ask them, what is flexible here? What are the trade-offs that other people have made in their job description? Usually the big trade-offs are about your amount of clinical time. Are you going to do this type of clinical time or that kind of clinical time? How would you structure your job in that way? And I think just asking those types of things can be really, really, from my perspective, helpful. And if they don't tell you, that's a good sign that maybe this isn't the right fit, right? You want to work for somebody that you can trust when you ask a question, we'll tell you. And if they tell you, this is a standard job, this is how we bring everybody on, you can change things as you move along, I would just stick with the celebrating part and don't stress about it because there will be plenty of opportunity. I think as Vinny has made such a great point, over time to go back and tweak that as you move forward. So that's my advice. I have, I've taken a lot of jobs and just maybe this, I shouldn't say this. I've never ever used a lawyer. Vinny, have you ever gotten a lawyer to look at anything?
I have not either, but I think that might be because I have not moved around a lot. I've only stayed here. So I have a pretty good understanding of the letters that are being given to me. I do think that I'm part of a group of women leaders, and I do know that if you're in the running for the big job at a corporation or, at a health system and you're moving, I do think that's where a lawyer might be helpful because you're taking a big, big leap and it's a big job and there's going to be a lot of things to think about. But I do think at the level of these very introductory letters, I don't know that a lawyer is going to be helpful for you because things are so standard a lot of times. Having said that, read it. Make sure you read it and have a good understanding. A lot of times, I would say sometimes people get so excited that they don't really read very closely. And so that's where it's important to read it, make sure you understand what you're signing. And, you know, and if at any point people feel uncomfortable, they should get a lawyer. But that's not necessarily something that I've done for the internal negotiating that I've had to do, which I take as a sign of trust. If I had to get a lawyer, I would be worried in the internal negotiations. But if somebody had asked me to move cross country and uproot my family and, you know, make a big leap, I might get a lawyer just to make sure that if I thought this was a high risk, high reward opportunity in a different sector that I was unfamiliar with, I would probably get a lawyer just to make sure that I'm protected in case something happened.
Yeah. And I guess the only thing I would build upon that is to say that I just would bring it up because I don't think when you guys take the first job in a place that's hiring a lot of people with standard contracts, that is not a time where I think a lawyer is high value. And I see people do that all the time. And I am always wondering what they think they're going to find. You know what I mean? Like the secret contract in the bottom and the fine language with the like secret light that if you shine it on, it says you're going to have to work like all Sundays or something. And so I always wonder like who told them to do that, and they should just save their money and send it on the celebration, like more money on celebration, less money on lawyers.
I love that. I feel like celebrating is something that often we forget to do. And I think part of that just comes from like we're in this go, go, go state of mind that often just the field and the culture of medicine, even in the hospital, really with patients, we don't really celebrate those small victories. So I love that, Katrina, that you're emphasizing that. When I look at your bios, Katrina and Vinny, I am just so in awe about the way in which your career and the things that you get to do now are so tailored to who you are and what you care about and what your values are. And it sounds like from this discussion that it didn't always start that way. I mean, there was a starting job and you got to where you are today after lots of iterations. And, you know, I'd love to hear about what negotiating practices worked for you in your personal experience when you were negotiating for the job you have now. And maybe like what you wish you would have done differently, or maybe things really just fell into place. And so just to kind of hear that personal trajectory of how that landed.
You know, when I think about back on these different things, I think one of the best pieces of advice I've ever gotten, and I hope you guys get this advice from so many people, is just be you. You be you, right? And so I think the authenticity, as we talk about in these different areas, really is important. I think if I look back on the mistakes I made, I think it was that honestly, I spent too much time trying to think about being somebody else or like bringing other things to a negotiation that weren't actually me. And I think that's tricky because academic medicine has a lot of very strong opinions about what's important and what you should do and other things like that. I'll tell you a great negotiation story really quickly for me that I wouldn't do again. So when I got my first job, people told me I needed an administrative assistant. So I decided I was going to negotiate for an administrative assistant. Gosh knows why I need an administrative assistant. Nobody wanted to meet with me. I didn't get any phone calls. Like, what was I going to do with an administrative assistant? Nobody wrote me letters, but I needed an administrative assistant. So I decided I was going to have a third of an administrative assistant. Like, I don't even know how you buy a third of an administrative assistant. Okay. So my boss, I think at that point, was just done with me. And he's like, okay, fine. I don't know why I did that. When I look back on that, I was like, that was just ridiculous. It was back to Vinny's point. Like, I didn't need it. Somebody had just told me I should get it. So we realized like, you can't have a third of an administrative assistant. There wasn't anybody. So we hired this woman who was a temp to work a third of her time with me. I had nothing for her to do, right? Nothing. And so it kind of stressed me out. I had this person sitting here, nothing for her to do. Like, it was kind of a stressful thing to do. And so eventually, I will say, I had this brilliant moment that happened in a phone call with a guy named David Ash from the University of Pennsylvania, where I said, we were talking about actually selling Viagra over the internet. And I said, well, I could take this administrative assistant because most of what she was doing was surfing porn. This was back before they blocked porn on our computers. I said, I got somebody who can do a study on getting Viagra over the internet. And so I assigned her to go to every website and try to buy Viagra. And we actually wrote a paper, got published in the New England Journal. But when I look back on it, why on earth did I do that? That was crazy, right? So I think if I could do it all over again, I'd just be be yourselves. Like, know what you want to do. Have enough faith in yourself that if somebody tells you, you know, you need an administrative assistant and you know you don't have anything to do with the administrative assistant, like, don't ask for that. Do what matters to you. So I think if I could do that again, although we did get a paper on Viagra in the New England Journal.
That's
the other
awesome.
thing I'll say about this. We sent it in and the New England Journal accepted it with like nothing. Which I thought was the way it worked at that point. I think I was a very junior. Let me just tell you guys, that's not the way it works. That was the last time that has ever happened to me in my entire career. So that's what I would say about the things I could do better.
So I am reflecting on while Katrina's talking about coming out as a chief resident and wanting to be a leader in education. I was really obsessed by titles. I was like, you know, how can I get into the APTA meeting or the AAMC meeting without a title? I'll be a nobody. And I was doing medical education research at the time. And so I was getting a very interesting hybrid job to do medical education research. But I was like, you know, if I don't have a platform, how will I get into the meeting? And so the thing that I negotiated for from the get-go was my title, and that I needed a title in medical education because I felt that that was important. And the challenge with that was it created a position that didn't exist. And so I will say that was a great thing and also a pitfall, right? Because the minute you get a title, then it's like, well, what is this? What are you doing? And the great thing though, is it did give a lot of external validation and I got the doors open to be on committees and things like that. So I do get asked a lot about titles because I have a lot and is it important? And I always say, you know, you started by looking at the bios and I will say those bios are so selective for the things that are mission driven. All jobs have grunt work. I'm scanning and faxing papers, you know, I'm signing random things, you know, and I'm doing a lot of grunt work. And that's just par for the course as well. So just keep that in mind where, you know, your job is to make sure that you have parts of your job that you love so that they sustain you over things that you that are just routine. And it's like anything. Some people go into fields like endocrinology because they love the thyroid. And of course, they know they're going to see diabetic patients. And that's the bread and butter. And maybe the bread and butter is not as exciting as that pheochromocytoma case, but they are excited by the totality of it and the options. And so, but everyone sees diabetic patients, right? And so it's the same sort of thing. And, you know, I would argue diabetes patients can be very exciting because it's, you know, important from a variety of lenses. So find the excitement in your job and figure out how to grow the excitement in a way strategically. But remember, you have to also do the things you're paid to do. And so for me in medical education, that meant, and I tell this to a lot of people, early in your career, you're doing a lot of interviews. You're doing a ton of recruiting and interviews and, you know, being a people person, doing a lot of volunteer work, a lot of advising that may be unpaid, but you're doing that to get your feet wet, to establish yourself as a go-to person so that you can then get the job that you want. And then on titles, I will say that if a title is important because you are going into the quality space or an education space or something, you might not get it right away, but you might just highlight, this is my goal. And so I highlighted that one of my goals was to become an associate program director. And I didn't get that on the get-go. I was chief resident. I didn't get that offer. But when a new program director was put into place with a new chair, my section chief was able to advocate for me to say, you know, I think she's done a lot of work and you might benefit from having her as an associate program director. And that was right around the time quality safety teaching was important. And so I got the APD position. And so I'm just letting you know that it can't hurt to let people know where you want to go. Don't expect that the silver platter is coming. Say it in a way that it's like, where I see myself going one day is this. And again, you don't need to say that on the get-go. You can say that a year in or at your faculty review. Those are the types of things that matter.
Wow. I'm just really processing and taking in all that you both have shared because it's not just tips, best practices for negotiations, but it's really like life advice. And I just can't say how helpful this has been. Before we wrap up, I just wanted to make space if either of you, Vinny or Katrina, have just any last reflections to share with us.
Well, maybe I'll close by saying I get asked a lot about negotiating, as you can imagine. And And I also get told and asked, and everybody believes that women are terrible negotiators. I guess if I could leave you guys with one thought is that I think if you all think about some of the strongest negotiators in your world, you're going to know they're women. They're mothers advocating for their children, their wives advocating for what's going on with their husbands in the hospital, right? If you look at women, we are incredible advocates and negotiators. I think the best in the world. I think if you look at that globally, you look at that anywhere. So what is the disconnect? So from my perspective, women advocate because they care about something other than themselves. They are advocating and negotiating because they care about something. So when you guys go in to negotiate, stop thinking it's about yourself. It's not about you. It's about the work you're going to do, the lives you're going to help, the suffering that you're going to reduce. It is not about you. It's about all those other people. And if you guys keep that front and center, you will hit it out of the park.
I really love that, Katrina. And I think that that only grows the higher up the ladder you go. In order to be successful, you're negotiating not for your personal success, but for your program, your chair, your department, the people. Many things that we do as leaders is to cultivate junior leaders and to train the future. You're setting yourself up so the next generation is successful. And what you need to know is how are you going to be successful so you can coach the next generation? And so these are really, really important questions. And I would say that when you talk to people, and the one thing that I will say is that don't be afraid to ask and be honest about what it is that you need to be successful. At the end of the day, you don't want to take a job that you don't feel good about. You really do not want to do that. And so you want to know, if I look at this job, will I be happy in this job? Am I happy to take this job? If there's something that's holding you back, that's what you negotiate for. You see what I'm saying? The key is that you're making it so that you can take the job and feel good about it, so that you can celebrate, and then you start that relationship. And that shows that you've got really, really, you're really thoughtful and you're in it to win it for the long term, not for the short term.
Katrina and Minnie, this has been such an inspiring, eye-opening, informative discussion, and we are just so incredibly grateful to learn from you. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, you guys, and good
luck. That's a wrap, folks.